Welcome to this online event held by the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. My name is Jussi Albrekka. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Bergen. Today's event is the second in the series, in the seminar series, Building Collaborations in the Sociological Analysis of European Elites. And the introduction today, or rather the talk today, is entitled Career Hubs as Corporate Global Networks. It's one presentation, but it's three speakers. The first is Felix Bühlmann. He's an associate professor at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland. The second is Anton Grau Larsen, assistant professor at Copenhagen Business School. It's Christoph Hermann Ellersgaard, associate professor at the Copenhagen Business School, and Jakob Ågård Lunding, who is a PhD student also at the CBS in Copenhagen, has contributed to the presentation. Now, these are all experienced researchers into the sociology of elites. And they will introduce the concept of career hubs as an analytical strategy to understand corporate global business elites, ultimately asking, can we identify global career hubs? And will those career hubs differ according to the national context in countries such as the US, the UK, Germany, France, Japan, or China? This event forms part of the International Inequalities Institute's Wealth, Elites and Tax Justice research team, led by Professor Mike Savage. Mike is attending the presentation from the train on his way to London. And the final event in this seminar series is entitled Changing Elites. This will take place on Wednesday, the 16th of June. Registration can be found in the chat function, along with details to future events held at the III. Just so you know, this online event is being recorded and live streamed at the LSE International Inequality Institute's Facebook page, and it will be made available as a video and podcast subject to no technical difficulties. And please note that today's event is a meeting rather than a webinar, and we are keen to see as many of our audience as possible. If attendees could therefore keep themselves muted with the cameras on where possible, this will ensure a smooth running event. There will be a chance to pose questions to the speakers towards the end of the event, and please either use the raise hand function to ask your questions directly or paste it into the chat function stating your name and affiliations in both cases. It will be my responsibility as the chair to see to that the questions are both asked and answered. But I will now hand the floor over to our speakers. Thank you everyone for joining in, and please enjoy the event. Felix, you're the one who will start, so the floor is now yours.
Okay, so thank you very much, Jules. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Victoria and Nina, for the work you've done to make this possible. We're very happy to be here. You see here the title of our presentation, which is Career Hubs as Corporate Global Networks. So as Jules already mentioned, we're not going to talk about Switzerland or about Denmark. We are going to do presentation together on global networks, and we thought it could be a good occasion for this network to speak on this more comparative topic. So it will be about how to compare different countries and their elites. So that should fit quite well. We're also going to speak about data handling, data management a bit, and how we did this. So this maybe could also be something which could be interesting for several of you. And finally, I mean, as we're not going to speak about our little countries, which sometimes is difficult to convince other people why they should be interested in Switzerland or Denmark, we are going to speak about your countries. So we hope also to have a lot of input from your side, because we probably speak about things that you know much better than we do at least to a certain degree in certain aspects. And then we're very happy to have your comments and your input on this. So Christoph, we can go to the second one. So I will first do a kind of a little background introduction. So the question if there is a global business elite has been widely debated. I think there are three main views on this question. So there is one group that thinks there is one united global business elite. The concepts here are transnational capitalist class from Sclair, but also the transnational business community or this idea of a global network of firms that own all the other firms. Then there's also a second, more regional view that puts the emphasis on the regional level, kind of an intermediate scale. So here the ideas are the North Atlantic ruling class or the Atlantic heartland of capitalism, but also ideas that there are several regional clusters, elite clusters in the world. And there's also maybe a last tradition which emphasizes that transnational elites are a myth, are not really happening. And Michael Hartmann is probably one of the most important proponents of that view. And there's also certain authors who speak about national career models. So all these approaches, they are using different analytical dimensions. So some of them, they are looking at the lifestyles of elites, the community of elites, the identities of elites. There's been a recent contribution by Bruno Cousin, Sébastien Chauvin, about the global bourgeoisie, and they were very much interested in how these people have a common lifestyle. There's others, maybe a more technical analysis of interlocking directorates, very much linked to network analysis about control, about maybe also political power of elites. So the strategic interests in business that economic elites can have. And there's maybe a third analytical dimension, which is about education, a common mindset, a common way of thinking, a common worldview, a common knowledge base, maybe also, which goes very much through the analysis of educational institutions. So what we would like to bring in is a further approach, which we call the career hub approach. So what is this about? The ideas here is that that elites are connected by common career episodes. So the idea is that different firms are actually connected by people who make careers in these different firms. So one person can move from one firm to the other and thereby connect different firms to each other. And also people are maybe connected by specific firms because they have been working for the same firm, have been influenced by the same firm in a specific way. So this idea that elites can also be connected not only by interlocks, but also by career episodes. Our idea is that there is probably a small number of firms that serve as these career hubs, as we call them. So the career hubs are the firms through which a lot of those business elite move. And I think we think that we're going to find a small number of those firms which could be central nodes in the network in a certain way. And we also think that the career hub approach can put the emphasis on what we could call the elite socialization. So these people go through these career hubs probably when they are younger, so at the beginning of their career, at the entry of their career. So we think that these people's minds are formatted in a certain way by these firms, and that these people, when they leave these career hubs to go elsewhere, they will make circulate the knowledge that they have acquired in those career hubs. Career hubs can also be a signal. So sometimes, like elite universities, if you have been at a certain elite universities, just the fact that you have been there becomes a signal. And maybe it's the same thing with certain career hubs. If you have been at a prestigious firm, maybe this this sign becomes, or this fact becomes a sign for other firms that then will recruit you, or maybe even these career hubs try to infiltrate certain of their clients by sending their people in other firms. But it's not going to be about control. So this is the main difference with ownership and interlocking directorates analysis. Just to show you quickly the main approaches that we have in that field. So Christoph, if you could go to the next. The contributions. Yeah, sorry. Christoph was quicker than I was. So the contributions that we can make with the Career Hub approach is first that it's in our view, it's a complementary framework for studying elite coordination. We don't want to replace other frameworks, but we think maybe with that approach, with that emphasis on career hubs, we can find different things. As I said, linked to these to the issues of knowledge, the issues of economic socialization. We also would like to kind of improve a certain point in those analyses of business elites. This is the kind of the articulation between different scales, between different levels. So we would like to try to better understand a bit the links that exists between the global level or the regional level and the national level. So how national networks are embedded within global networks and how global networks have an influence on the national level. We also have some points to propose when it comes to data. So we have used a specific form of data. So the Bordex data, which is a huge business database, and we have tried to link it to the Forbes list through a kind of a wiki data procedure. Anton will be going to show you a bit more about this. And also we have, or rather Anton has proposed a specific methodological innovation, a new way of weighting career networks and to make these networks work for our analysis. So just quickly, the different views, I think you already know these different views on business elites, on global business elites, but just to recall these different analytical frameworks, this global view is, I think, composed of two different approaches. There is the one approach which is based on Sclair's idea of a transnational capitalist class, which is interested in mainly in lifestyles, in a common ideological perspective, in common ideas, a common discourse, and maybe also a similar interest that a certain world-spanning class would have. And the second approach here is the approach based on the global networks of control, of ownership, and for example, this idea from the Vitali et al. Article in 2011 that there exists a single network, one single global network of a small but densely connected network of financial firms who kind of own each other, but also all the rest. So this is the global view, but at the same time, I think the most important view nowadays, or for some years, is a second view, which we call the regionalist or the regional view. Christoph, yeah, exactly. So this is based mainly or around this group by Ilke Hemskerk, William Carroll, and they have very much this idea that it's not necessarily a global business elite, but that business elite is kind of organized around what they call a North Atlantic heartland. So the link between the US, the UK, also the Netherlands. And from there on, you have in an analysis from 2016 from Hemskerk and Takis, you have this idea of different elite communities. So there would be a North Atlantic community, then several European communities, an Asian community. And so these networks would be organized also by a regional level, kind of an intermediate regional level. And the mechanisms that would kind of structure these regional levels would be the distance between these different businesses, but also specific regional business cultures, and also language as a factor which plays a role for the North Atlantic core, but also for example for the French network, etc. And their results are basically, there is this North Atlantic core which is at the center, and then there's a European community which is at the same time getting denser over the years with the European unification process, but also getting fragmented in different networks. And there's Asia, which is has come a bit closer, but is still quite disconnected from the rest. And then there is the national view, this idea there's still nationally exclusive countries, for example, France, China, Japan, because these countries have national career models, national systems of elite universities, which prevent a kind of blending with other elites from other countries. And there's also this idea of national career models, which would kind of prevent the jumping from outside into a national model. So these are the three models, and we would like now to know with our approach, what is the overall structure of the elite network based on career hubs? Is it close to what we have seen in those three approaches? Do we find similar things or do we find different structures? Secondly, we want to go a bit closer and see who are the central career hubs? What kind of firms are these career hubs? So what are they and what are their characteristics, and why also could they be in this role? And finally, we would like to find also certain mechanisms that can explain the embeddedness of these career hubs in different countries and regions. So why are certain countries, certain regions more central in that network and others more peripheral? So I give the word over to Anton for the method part.
Yes. Okay. So I will talk briefly about data and methods. Christoph, if you go to the next slide. So we are, you know, if we're going to look for a globally connected career network, then we need global careers, obviously, and we need them from we would suspect that we would need a rather large data set with not just the top CEOs, but like more than the chairman and the CEO, but like the whole board of management, or perhaps even some lower than that, because you know people do shift firms rarely, so you know we need a lot of ties, so we need them from organizations that act globally, so that you know it would be likely that you could have a career in English headquartered firm in India because they would have offices in India and so forth. And the Forbes Global 2000 list is what we took. It's the world's largest public companies, and that means that it does miss some state firms. The criteria for inclusion are not perfect, but it's a pretty good picture of the world economy today. Some of the most important firms. And then we have a massive data set, which is the BoardX data set, which has boards and careers for a large population, mostly in Western firms. And the data set we have is from 2018, with past collect positions as well, and it's 7 million positions. Now, this is collected not for research, but for business intelligence, and it's a somewhat unclear collection method. So it's a very messy data, and which I'll show you in the next slide. But in order to match those two data sets, we used Wikidata, which is like it's the little sister of Wikipedia, but it's part of the same thing. And it Wikidata, we used that for you know, basically we looked up all the firms, both in the Forbes list and in the Bordex one, inside Wikidata. And then if they found the same thing, then it's a match. And there was a lot of hand cleaning as well. And Wikidata includes almost all famous corporations, but it also includes tons of other corporations as well. So through a long process, which I'll tell you about, we found 1,300 Forbes firms, which is less than 2,000. And we're missing mainly Japanese banks and some Chinese firms, and then some firms that should not have been in the Forbes list at all, like stuff that was subsidiaries of other stuff or things that don't really exist. So a smaller sample. We have 16,000 senior managers, and they hold 150,000 positions in 17,000 organizations. Like the 17,000 organizations is a bit shaky, but because they're not all completely well clean, but you know, it's that ballpark. Okay, next slide. So this is the process of cleaning. And cleaning is 80% of analytical data work. And I assure you, we have put in the hours here. Okay, so we start out with the raw data as it comes from Bordex, which you can see in the first column called affiliation. Christoph, if you can point that out with the mouse, yeah. And then we do some simple algorithmic cleaning where we throw away if you look at Christian Dior, like the second row, you can see that the Bordex guys, they add stuff like what this was previously called and whatnot. We try to remove that as well as AS, APS, all those kind of legal entity names. Now we have like a match name that already cleans something for us, but we need to know if if two entries are actually from the same firm. And in this case here, we're looking at Bernard Arnault, like he's a very rich French guy. And he's the owner of Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy International. And it's called LVMH. And that's the name that for this firm that we want to end up with. So we've sent the match name to Wikipedia, Wikidata, and it returns a match, which, you know, what firm it thinks this is. And then we get a massive matrix, and then we sit and say, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, right? According to some sort of quality criteria. And that took a while. But we're used to prosopographical data, so it usually takes even longer. So what you can see here, what the process did was we started out with Christian Dior, Groupe Arnault, SAS, LVMH, Moët Hennessy, Vuitton, you know, these long weird names. And then we ended up in the clean version with LVMH. And, you know, we do this for all the 16,000 all the 16,000 careers, and then if we get an LMVH, then they're connected. Okay, and then we also have like the role and stuff like that. That also needed coding and cleaning, which was also a lot of work, but unfortunately only done by hand, moving mainly by Phoenix. Okay, so the next slide. So what did Wikidata do for us? Because as you said, we sent it to it and then, you know, we got it back. But what Wikidata does is that it keeps a record of other names that a firm might have. And it also keeps a record of firms that they are merged into and their subsidiary and their holding structure. And Wikidata, the community there has like a common sense version of what an organization is, which is pretty close to what we think an organization is. So if you have a holding company, then they would just put it into, and like they would lump them all together because they wouldn't think of them as singularly important entities, which they often are not. So that's a really, and that's, if you've ever tried working with bigger corporate registers, this is a massive problem. And Wikidata handles that pretty well. And what it also does is that it increases the means of production for, or data production, because this procedure, that we did, you know, allowed us to clean a much larger data set than we would otherwise have bothered to do. And it does that across countries and languages that we don't know, and the countries that we don't really understand, but the local Wiki communities do understand them, and then we can draw on that. So that's a massive benefit. Other benefits is then it connects to other databases, like the Louis Vuitton one is connected to, I think it was 32 different databases from that one. And then it's a source of data in itself. And and then there was another thing, which is that it's not AI or machine learning, anything super weird. It's somewhat plausible to get into it. Okay, so next slide. The method. Well, basically, we turn the you usually would turn like a network into like a career sequence into a network. Once a person shifts from one firm to another, like in this case, for instance, he works in Bell Labs and then he moves to General Electric. So that's one tie, and then that tie, it goes in one direction. So it's a directed network. And in the graph here, the example graph I've made here, we have two careers. We have one CFO, Chief Financial Officer, and a CTO, a Chief Technical Officer. And the chief technical officer, he works in technical kind of firms. So he works at Bell Labs, General Electric, and then he's off to Apple Incorporated. While the CFO, well, she works at Ernst & Young, General Electric, because she's in GE Capital, and then goes to Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank. Now, not this seems straightforward, but the problem is here that in this type of network, there isn't, when we calculate the path lengths and the centralities, there's no difference for the sake of Bell Labs between Apple, which it has a really career trajectory to, and to Goldman Sachs. They're equally far apart. This is two steps away. And this is obviously unsatisfactory, because we want to look at path lengths or paths where there's actually been a person moving between them. And we want to break with the normal assumption, which is in network analysis, that all nodes redirect independently of where you come from. So if you come from Bell Labs, General Electric will send you anywhere. And if you come to General Electric, it will send you anywhere, which is weird. It's, you know, it's depending on the path that you come from. Okay, next slide. So we created a weighted career network. And I'm afraid I'll go through this one quickly. So the shtick is that we create a network for each career independently. Then we calculate the path length between the different nodes in each little network, and then we add them together, and then we weight the strength of a tie by how far it is, you know, how far away it is. So a direct exchange, like between Bell Labs and General Electric, is a one, but an indirect exchange, like Bell Labs through General Electric to Apple, is a half, and you can see that in the graph here. So what we do is that we connect all the firms in a career, and then we weight the edges, right? And that has, next slide. Boom, that has the benefit that now the distances in the matrix reflect actual change of careers. So if there's a weak tie between two firms, we know that there's actually been a person going through all the firms. And that still allows us to identify central hops, large components and stuff. We can differentiate between stages in a career, like are you mainly in early career or late career? And so that's really nice. But as you can see also from my little example here, is that it, the network is a bit weird because it's made out of little, small, perfectly connected clusters. And we don't really yet know, you know, to what extent we could use other more fancy measures like closeness between us or community detection, because does that make sense in this type of graph? But it works for our purposes now. Okay, so I think I have taken my time. So on to you, Christoph.
Thank you, Anton. So what did happen when we tried to look at the world's largest firms and actually make them into a career network? Well, basically, it looks like this, a giant hairball. Everything is connected. And actually, I think this is interesting in its own right. We don't really, from an overall perspective, find that many different communities. We find something, the world economy of the large Forbes 2000 firms are actually connected. And there are also a couple of firms, 20, which we'll call like core firms, which are really, really important. Because actually, of all the Forbes directors, of all the almost 17,000 executive careers we find, 35% of these have passed through just one of 20 firms. So just when we start and we will look more into these, which we will call the Global Career Hubs later on, just imagine that basically since these firms have 12 directors each, that in each firm, there's around, on average, three directors which has had a career in one of these hubs. So this is not trivial. It's really, really well connected, actually. And what are these hubs then? Basically, we find three different types of firms. We find global audit and consulting firms. We find global banking institutes. And we find some US conglomerates. And with the global audit firms, we find the big four. We find PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young, KPMG, and Deloitte. We also find the last element of the big five, Arthur Andersen, which of course, after Enron, stopped working, but are still, for many people, since they made their careers many years ago, an important hub. And then lastly, we also find McKinsey & Company as the last of these six firms. We also find a number of global bank institutes in order of their centrality or their degree in this network. We find Citigroup, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and then also a couple of European banks, Deutsche Bank, UBS, and Credit Suisse from Switzerland. Lastly, we also find some large American conglomerates. We find GE, IBM, PepsiCo, Procter & Gamble, and Hewlett Packard. There's one other thing that is an important career hub, and that is to have worked in the federal executive departments of the American state. But these are the 20 firms that, as I said, 35% firms and organizations that 35% of all Forbes managers have been into. So there's also an interesting thing which we can do is to look to what extent are these careers that people have in the formative early years, or is these endpoints? And here you also see that we have colored this map with either red or black letters. And the red letters are companies that are not for organizations that are not in Forbes, which is all the more astonishing for the consultancy and audit firms that they're very, very central in this network despite not being Forbes firms. So they're not there themselves, in a sense, from where we started. This also means that their careers tend to be earlier, they tend to be have a larger proportion of their careers in the early half, as is, of course, careers in other types of non-corporate corporations, not least the American, different elements of the American state and military, and also careers, for instance, at top universities. And not surprisingly, Harvard is the university with the highest degree in this network. We can also look at how, to what extent these firms with a high degree then are global. There's a very strong correlation between the firm's degree and how many countries it is actually active in. You can perhaps see here that there's even a tendency that the global audit firms are a little bit more transnational, active in more countries than we would expect, as are some banks, while others are more middle of the road. And of course, again, over here, the specific American government and also other governments, of course, less transnational than the corporations. So basically, as we said, the overall structure of the career network is dense, but when we start to look at where the Forbes firms are placed, we can also see some level of clustering. Here I have the American network. You can see most of these are very central, but also some on the right side of your screen. If we look at the UK firms, they are mostly central, tilting a little bit to the left, some of them. The German ones are both, some of them in the central cluster, but also some of them tilting to the left, where we also find the French ones a little bit below, also clustered together. And lastly, the Japanese countries, which are more dispersed around the network and actually do not cluster to the same extent. We'll come back to that. I will also just show you Scandinavia for the sake of it, very clustered up here. So overall, and this is perhaps the most important overview of our finding, is that here you see the firms and how many firms there are in each country or regions, and also the proportion of careers within firms in these nations that go through a particular career cluster. Also, you can then see it divided upon the consultancies, the banks, and the conglomerates. So basically, you just have a second to glance through this, but you can see that basically we go from between a little bit less than 10% of careers that have been through the core 20 corporations up to about 45%, but also there's the difference. But in trying to keep things a bit simple, we can at least kind of identify two types of ideal types. We can find those who countries who are where careers are very connected to what we can call the global center, not least in the US. Also, the US a very even distribution, like there is in the global network, which of course also because the US firms constitute almost half of the Forbes firms here, but also similar in the UK. In UK, especially consultancies are very strongly represented. In Switzerland, dominated by banks. And also in Ireland, where consultancies again have a strong presence. Felix will try in a few minutes to come with a more precise interpretation of this, but it probably won't surprise you that we'll be talking about tax havens. Secondly, we can also find countries where the career path are more national, as Felix mentioned. This is definitely the case in France, where we find much less people who've been in the global course. It is also the case in Japan, and perhaps more surprisingly, even to us in this room, in Scandinavia, where which is quite disconnected from the core. So I'll just use my last 2 minutes on trying to show you how this looks when we kind of look into the national embeddedness of the global career hubs. And we'll try with some of the ones who were in the global center, and then we'll gradually move towards national champions. So let's start by looking at the United States of America, where you on your left-hand side see the network and you see all the Forbes corporations or corporations that are connected to one of the global hubs. The black, if something has a black dot, then it's a Forbes corporation. If it has a black cross, then it's a corporation that is connected, but not a Forbes corporation. So it's another organization in our data. Basically, it's kind of hard to say anything from the US network other than that all the global firms in the global core are also very central in the American core. UBS, which is ranked 19 in the world network, is ranked, which you see here, is ranked 27th in the US network. So there's a very high correlation between where these things are. This is basically something that looks very similar. If we go to the United Kingdom, you see a similar network as well. The US government, unsurprisingly, is not very important a career hub within British, when we only look at directors who sit at executive positions in UK firms. But otherwise, we find something which is fairly similar, and also all UK firms are placed, all the top 20 UK firms are placed in the global top 100. But of course, you see some British banks suddenly having playing an important role, and the in particular the American conglomerates playing less of a role in the UK. Moving to Germany, more things change. First of all, we see much less central global firms becoming central in the German career network. And we also see in particular the American conglomerates losing out, and also a couple of the consultancy firms, while for instance, McKinsey has an even stronger presence in Germany than globally. And then moving towards national champions in France, again, here we see a major change. We see the banks being out of the French top 20, all of them. We see the French government having a state career being the most important career hub in France. And otherwise, we again primarily see the consultancy having key positions. Lastly, moving to Japan, we see a completely different mode of career networks. This is probably based on the kind of Kairetsu model of Japanese corporate governance. People make careers within their own corporate groups. And in spite of the fact that, for instance, the global auditing firms actually have a lot of activity in Japan, they're not very central in the Japanese networks. A couple of banks are, but it's a much, first of all, they play a much smaller role. And secondly, it's important to see also that this network is much less dense. So basically a lot of what happens in Japan is that big firms do not recruit each other's managers way to the same extent. So in a sense, they're not really part of that community. So this was the key findings, and Felix will now reflect upon them in our attempt of making a conclusion.
Yes, so thank you. So these data or these analyses are really fresh, fresh from the oven, and we try to do a first kind of a first attempt of interpreting this and see what's happening here. And what we think could happen here is if you look at these countries, that we have kind of three structuring forces which kind of structure these career networks, these elite networks based on career hubs. So there is a first structuring force as we have seen in finance and banking, we see that Switzerland is very much structured in this way. Germany also, because of Deutsche Bank, of course, also the UK, we'll see that. Then we think we might find a second structuring force, which is about tax and wealth defense. So we have to look into this a bit more, but we found that, for example, those conglomerates are very present in Ireland, in the Netherlands also. And we finally have the consulting and knowledge brokering as structuring force. There we have the entrance portals like the UK, Ireland. So most of these firms were UK firms or were UK US firms or came from the US through the UK and Ireland to Europe. So in Ireland, Switzerland, also Italy, they are strong. But what we see also is that the consulting and knowledge and audit firms, they are present everywhere, also in China, also in Brazil. So they go very much also to the periphery. And as we will see, McKinsey is one of the most international career hubs. And then we thought there's also maybe some what we could call national repellence of those career networks. So some reasons why they don't go to all the countries. So we'll come back to this very briefly. So national education, government, maybe the local character of certain banks, and maybe also kind of a tax repelling function, maybe for Scandinavia, we will see that. So if we look into each of these structuring forces, here are about some thoughts we had on these. So we think, for example, that the finance and banking structuring force has certainly to do with financialization, the increasing importance of financial markets, and also the repeal of Glass-Steagall Act in 1999, and also the erosion of that act already before, which made then universal European banks go to America. For example, UBS, Credit Suisse, as you see here with those logos, they bought into the American investment banking market. And there was a kind of an integration, a banking finance integration happening around between 1995 and 2010. I think it's kind of dead now. But this was an important point, and this has brought careers together. So there is a North Atlantic integration of banks, which has still importance for careers in Switzerland, Germany, the UK. So many of those US investment bankers have then become top managers of German banks, of Swiss banks, of US banks. So this is certainly a first structuring force. A second one is maybe it's still a bit more shaky. We're not really sure of this, but if you look at the main table, you see that Ireland and the Netherlands have more of those conglomerates, of those American consumer good conglomerates in their career hubs, and not so much Switzerland. We're still figuring out why this is, but could be that it's just because we have limited ourselves to the 20 most important ones, and that other ones are slightly behind rank 20. But we could think that there's a strong presence of those conglomerates with European headquarters, with research centers in Ireland, in the Netherlands, and that could be a reason why the networks are so important. Third one is consulting and knowledge brokering. So here, the idea is, I think a first result is here that we really can delimit what are the most important career hubs here. And I think two things are important. One thing is McKinsey really stands out with consulting. So it's not about Boston Consulting Group or Booz Allen or Arthur Little or anything else. It's about McKinsey. And the second thing is maybe horizontally, I think what we nowadays call audit and what we call consulting is at least in terms of career hubs, very much the same thing. So it's not two different sectors, but one united sectors. And these firms, of course, they are here to broker knowledge between firms, to make circulate knowledge about management, about strategy, about organizing business all over the world, and kind of bring the American or the Western knowledge to the world. And they probably have, as I said, a kind of a similar function as elite universities, with the exception that they standardize elite selection, they maybe also standardize elite identities all over the world. And what we see is we have those entrance portals like the UK, like Ireland, but also a very wide international spread of that third structuring force. And then the repellents very quickly. I think why do certain countries, why are they less embedded in those global career hub networks? So I think one reason could certainly be the role of the state, the revolving doors between the state and the private economy, as in France, or also the strong role of the Grande École, the elite universities in France, could be the national career models, as we have seen for Japan, and could also be that banks have not connected to that American, British investment bank world, and maybe are not very welcoming as Scandinavian countries are not welcoming international companies who want to save taxes in their countries. So this is the first attempt of to interpret these things, and by thinking about those ways to interpret these networks, we thought there's really much to do with other literature here. So with literature about, for example, recruitment. So recruiting, trust-based recruiting based on certain signals that are coming from those firms. There is, I think we could go more into professional service firms, how those service firms are political agents of globalization. We could also go into between workplace inequalities. I think this is an important part. So how are these firms that really already in the beginning, when you start a career there, how are they elite firms? So the differences between these different firms, the construction of inequality through these networks. All these are things that we would like to go into in these next weeks. But this is it for now. And thank you very much for your attention. And we are happy to hear your questions.
Okay, everybody, I'll be the moderator of this. So I'll try to go through. We'll have to make a list here, starting with Marta Pagini. You're the first one on my screen with a raised hand, so you are the first to ask a question.
Thank you, Jos. Thank you for your presentation. It was really fascinating and very, very related to my research interests. And I have one question related to your conceptualization of how, like, this study would be global, because as far as I saw from the findings, countries in the global south are pretty much excluded from these career hubs, which maybe would be an interesting finding per se. And I was wondering, what did you think about it? And whether you found any like findings about regional ties related to the colonial history of certain countries. Thank you so much.
So who will start?
Yeah, I can try to give an answer. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the basis of our sample is the Forbes 2000 list, and we don't have all of the firms, so we only have 2,300. So this means, it means two things. So I think on the one hand, you are right, we don't have systematic samples for all of the countries of the global south. It's because these have much, much fewer transnational firms. And the second thing is also that you are right, it's part of our results also, that this is, I mean, it still is a core periphery structure of the network. So there's very much this North Atlantic core. And we see that also being at the periphery means that you are more disconnected from or less embedded in those networks. But what we see also is that, for example, if you look at China, If you look at Brazil, if you look at Russia, at least these BRICS countries, we find, for example, a relatively strong presence of the consultancies and the audit firms. So we think that these go really everywhere, and they kind of try to make business in almost all countries, and sometimes also the banks are going there, but they are at the periphery, but they are also a bit part of the network. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Sam.
Hi guys, thanks for that. Fascinating. I mean, it's not entirely connected in the sense that this isn't where you're at empirically at the moment, but I'm just kind of interested in your speculations on what you think the role that these hubs might play in the kind of coalescing of elite identities. Both importantly, I suppose, in relation to some notion of standardization of cultures within organizations that then is obviously implicated in recruitment, but also just more generally whether you think whether what's the hub like function doing in terms of elite identities, or what do you foresee as being the importance of the hubs in terms of what they're doing to elite identity? Any thoughts? Just is it an area I'm really interested in and have thought about in relation to educational institutions, but it's really I really like the idea of obviously thinking of these organizations as having a similar hub function.
I can try to have a go at that. At least one thing we've discussed is that this clearly signals that there's kind of a closed circuit labor market in a sense for some of these organizations. I also find like we kind of discussed that there's an interesting thing that very few of these firms A, produce stuff and B, many of them would have like the average salary of the workers there would be very different. These are places where you go to make a career in a sense. So in that sense, it's in many ways, I think some of these could be seen like it's a continuation of when you went to Oxbridge or to the Ivy League universities, that you stay in the same sort of career environment with people who may have gone to other elite universities, but probably have been there. Of course, what we then see, for instance, McKinsey or some of the others doing are then that they kind of also pick out the best and the brightest from local universities around the globe, but in that sense, I think it's a continued effect of corporate culture, and as you saw, we put yours and Daniel's book there as well, because it's kind of the whole kind of social reproduction that also goes on while people have a career. Is definitely also something that's worth looking into, since it's clear just from the numbers that these organizations at least has the potential to shape elite identities for quite substantial number of leaders of the corporate or global economic elite.
Anton, go ahead.
Yeah, just briefly, there's many ways that they could influence elite identity formation. I think one very central thing is gatekeeping. You know, like they filter through different habitual dispositions, and then they say, "Well, you're not McKinsey potential. You are," and other firms then rely on that gatekeeping function. And like say, okay, if McKinsey wants you, then we want you as well. So, and that, you know, obviously homogenizes the elite enormously.
We've also played a bit around with the idea that the CV it's kind of, and we could call it a form of institutionalized organizational capital or career capital, whatever, if we want to make up more production capitals. But the the idea is basically that these also serves as badges of honor that you've been in these places. So they also enter kind of a, it shows a kind of symbolic honor, which of course also can backfire. I mean, people with a career history in Goldman Sachs are perhaps, it's not something that is necessarily look positive upon when you select union leaders or leaders of left-wing political parties, but in this community at least it serves kind of to show that you, yeah, as Anton says, you, it works as a gatekeeping function, and we can probably use a lot of what we, the theoretical apparatus that we use to apply for elite universities, I think we can extend to understand the role of some of these career hubs.
And Mike has just asked the question that I wanted to ask myself. He asks, can you link university attended to your database? Because if McKinsey serves as an entrance portal, well, what are the characteristics that, well, in terms of university educations, of those selected by McKinsey? You mentioned Oxbridge, but is this mainly people recruited from a select set of American, UK, or other universities, or is it a more global or widespread phenomenon?
Well, we don't have we don't have directly the university data, so it's really based on their positions, and as those are huge numbers, we've not been able to go and look for their. For their universities, I would say I don't think this. For example, the consulting and audit guys, these are not necessarily kind of Americans going everywhere. I think these are. I mean, these firms, they are UK based or America based, but they have a federated structure. So they have, they are only kind of bound together by marketing, by knowledge circulation within the firm. And these kind of things. So I think they recruit locally. So the Deloitte guys in Russia are Russians, and the Deloitte guys in France are French. So I don't think that they will recruit from a specific cluster of universities. I think the university structure is still much more nationalized. But this is also why it is interesting, because I think these firms, they contribute some, yeah, as we said, like to the standardization of an elite identity or of an elite recruitment, which can function through these firms, which are present everywhere. And this is not the case for the university. So it can be a kind of a they can have a homogeneization function.
Victoria.
Yeah, thank you. Just wanted to mention that at least for McKinsey, I know that they also actively promote their staff going into other major firms, because obviously then they hope to build a network of new clients. And so they have kind of this alumni network. So I think that's also something maybe interesting for further research. Like, in what way do these firms actively promote this global hub and this global network?
Exactly. Yeah. There's a huge literature actually, just for the global professional service firms. So for example, Busebond, Falconbridge, and also for example for the elite identity, which is quite interesting. So the we have some of those ethnographic research on these identities. And what is interesting is, if you are, for example, at McKinsey or one of those firms, it doesn't matter which position you have. If you're in, you already can develop kind of an elite identity. For example, Alveson and Robertson, they have quite an interesting paper where they say, actually, so these firms try to foster an elite identity. They try to say to their employees, you are selected, you are an elite. And why are they doing it? Because in a certain way, the work there is so boring to a certain degree. So you have to work a lot. You're not necessarily doing interesting stuff, And I think the same is true for the first years as analyst in an investment bank. You're working, 15 hours a day, and you're not doing interesting stuff. So this distinctive element, being an elite, that you get by working in one of those firms is very important to keep those, to retain those employees, and to make them work productively. So this is very important. And I think it then later, as a kind of a more or less, yeah, as you say, maybe Victoria, a kind of a conscious or unconscious spillover effect, it then becomes, it's transformed into a signal for other firms. But it's true. I mean, they are really fostering this very strategically and trying to create alumni groups that then are going to those other firms in order to get new clients and to densify relationships with clients they already have. Yeah.
But I guess it would be too difficult to try to do an analysis of the careers of those who leave McKinsey for other firms. You would need data that would be very hard to come by. But it would be an interesting case to do a sequence analysis of these to see the degree of integration and the career homogeneity of the different McKinsey candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be possible with the Bordex data, actually. We could look at only those who have been through one firm, for example, and then see what is going to happen for them afterwards. This is not the approach that we have chosen here, but with a bit of cleaning, it would be possible.
Yeah. Thierry, and after that, Fabien.
Thank you, guys. It was great. I was just wondering. At the beginning, you presented, three views on how connections are articulated at the international levels. So there was the global, the regional, and the local or the national. And I'm not sure I saw that afterwards in the results, and I was just wondering actually if it's not part of the results, couldn't you be able to test for that, at the career level, and maybe also because you try to explain the network structure and the career structure by country. So couldn't you try to test those hypotheses at the country level and see which view works, maybe at the global level, but also for each country cases. So that was my question.
I think so, Jerry. I think we with the kind of table where I think we've discussed a lot. I think we're most in support of a kind of a regional view or kind of a diffusion view where we clearly see the US, the UK, and Ireland and Switzerland as kind of seems quite integrated, and also then kind of these more regional structures. But also, I think what is new here is that there are these professional service firms that seems to act in a more global way. Basically, the career hubs are everywhere, but to a different extent. And there's also, as Felix says, a very clear core periphery thing. But I think perhaps kind of the right way to talk about it would be to talk about some very integrated firm countries and some in which are partly integrated, and then some which still has a quite strong national features still.
I have a small comment. I think I also heard Thierry's question as whether individual careers actually move across countries, because as Felix was saying, the Deloitte guy in Russia is perhaps Russian, and so he could move between different companies, but in Moscow, being in Moscow the entire time. And I think global cities are super important for this. So it's much easier to exchange between these global hubs in London and Paris and Moscow than it is in Copenhagen. But unfortunately, the data does not allow us to do that because we don't know the country of all the non-Forbes firms. We kind of do, but not really. But perhaps it's an avenue as well, because do the CEOs themselves move across countries? We actually don't answer that question. We answer, do they move between international firms from different countries, which is probably related.
What strikes me yet again is there's a kind of parallel here to the work partly undertaken by François Denor, Sylvain, and Paul Lagnon in Monet, and also by Richard Collignon and his group. François and co. have studied the circulation of the Enarchs. Collignon studied the Japanese higher civil servants, the so-called Amakudari principle. Are we looking at a model, or rather principle, which used to be found among the higher civil servants, which somehow extends into private sector, but with new institutions as the hubs they need to pass through, in this case, McKinsey? Is the logic, if not identical, then at least it displays some clear similarities?
Structurally, there could be a kind of parallels between those cases. So at one country level, and this being a more international level, where other instances play have a kind of a functional equivalent, functionally equivalent function, for these careers. So I could imagine, even though I think there's also differences then, because these firms, they have other, these structuring forces also showing that they are trying to, why are they going there, or why are they going where they are going, is also because they see business opportunities somewhere, or they want to be in those markets. So they accompany certain firms, or they go there because they think there's a potential, and this is the logic, I think, that is behind their geographical spread as well. So this is one of the differences, certainly.
Fabien, did you want to ask a question or not? I think you raised your hand, but then you lowered it again. And
at first, I didn't want, but now I have a question.
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's just a clarification question. Could you go back to your waiting procedure for the links between the notes? There's one thing I missed, I think. Okay. So it's very, very simple. Why is there a link in between Bell Labs and Apple Inc. if the guy CTO goes from Bell Lab to General Electric, then to General Electric to Apple Inc.?
Yeah. So in my hurry to make the table, unfortunately, I made an error, and I'm very embarrassed for that. The reason why there's a link between Bell Labs and Apple Inc. is that if you imagine the CTO's, like this guy's career, you imagine it first as a chain, and then we connect all the firms to each other, so it becomes like a perfect clique, like you see with Goldman Sachs, General Electric, Deutsche Bank, AU, like a perfect clique. And then we weight each tie by the length, how far it is away from each other in the chain, in the initial chain. So the path length. So if it, let's say they start out in, she starts out in Ernst & Young and ends up in Deutsche Bank. That's three steps away. So the edge between Ernst & Young and Deutsche Bank is a third because it's divided by the path length. So in the other case, like General Electric, he starts out in Bell Labs, goes to General Electric and ends up in Apple. Now there's a path length of two inside his little career between Bell Labs and Apple. That is then converted to a direct link between Bell Labs and Apple of a half, which means like it's half the strength because it's a path length of two, which would be one divided by two. Is that clear?
Yes, but I wouldn't put any link in between Red Bell Labs and Apple Inc., for example.
The reason why you want to do that is, and I probably went too fast over it. But the reason why we do it is that if you don't put a link between Bell Labs and Apple directly, then when we calculate the distance between Bell Labs and Apple, then there's no difference between Bell Labs from the point of Bell Labs, there's no difference between Goldman Sachs and Apple. They're equally far apart because we don't know that they're connected, that one is connected through a career and the other is not. And that's very unsatisfactory.
Okay, I see.
So if you don't make the tie directly, then there's no way for any algorithm to know that Apple and Bell Labs are closer to each other because they share a career.
Basically, Anton and I discussed this because we discussed if you come from, let's say you have done a PhD at the Department of Sociology at University, for example, of Copenhagen, for instance, and then you later work at the Copenhagen Business School, and then afterwards you go to work at Roskilde University. That creates a link. But if we don't distinguish that, we can also see a person working at the Department of Economics in University of Copenhagen, then working at CBS, and then getting a job at Danske Bank, which would then, if we didn't do this, we would kind of confuse. We could have the risk that there were some connectors, like, for instance, a conglomerate like GE, who would make stuff appear closer where there's actually no real career path within them, because there's division within these large entities where they only send people in, so to speak, different directions. So that was the idea, to avoid overestimating something just because it sends to one thing that is prestigious, because maybe there's this kind of different path within these entities.
Okay. Thank you.
And probably doing it like this and not doing a real network, if I remember correctly, doing it in this more tedious way doesn't really change stuff that much, but it feels more correct. So
it's unsatisfactory to say that two firms are close to each other, but there's no people moving between them. That's unsatisfactory. It's basically difficult to explain. But again, like with all network stuff, it's just driven by degree. Everything is just degree. So, you can try to do more fancy stuff, but you end up with something that's 80% just degree.
I have a question, a technical one. Why didn't you use Orbis and instead use Vortex? Because with the project, we always talked about Orbis, but never about Vortex. So,
Felix?
Because you have better career data. I mean, the careers. So what you really have, so you know all the positions that these people had, and so Orbis is a very good database in my view, if you for interlocking directorates, when it comes to ownership, and it's much bigger. So it's much if you're interested in the whole world, it probably has a better coverage of the periphery or of the countries of the global south and these things. but it has not so so good data on people and on this career aspect is really what makes one of the strengths of Bordex, even though it's also not perfect career data, but it's quite good, and you can with a bit of cleaning you can really kind of try to reconstruct the careers of those people, and that's that what we've been doing.
Fantastic, thank you so much.
Yeah, I can add to that that one thing, one challenge that we usually struggle with is when you have career data is that often we have relied on like year to year data that we know this guy was from that year to that year, he was at McKinsey, then from that year he was in another firm. With the approach we do now, we only care about the sequence of shifts, not the duration or the exact time it happened. And that's a lot less, it's a much lower data bar, you know, it's much easier to get that data. You can imagine doing that for scraping CVs, that they're usually ordered in the right way. People might have misentered a certain year or not entered the year, but then the order is still pretty okay. That is also like a benefit of this approach with regard to how we've usually done it, which is much, much higher data quality, much more knowledge about each individual and that stuff. But this is a new thing.
With 5 minutes left, we've got time for one or two more questions. And there is a clarifying comment from Paul Agnoy-Monet. Orbis is mainly about business data. Bordex is more about individuals.
I got a question, if I may.
Yeah.
I remember, so of course, thank you for your presentation and so on and so on. I remember that when we were discussing about the Danish case, for instance, you very much insisted on the prominence of companies like Maersk, tended to be like to play a role equivalent to those 20 core firms. Does your study confirm this status for companies like Merck in Denmark, and or not?
Well, it doesn't 100%. The problem with Denmark is that there's only 12 four firms, if I remember correctly. So when we go down to that level, it becomes, you probably want to basically get more data on the smaller countries, because I'm sure from our other data that it would be seen, but in the current Danish graph, Maersk is not that prominent, but other who has served the same function as medical giant Novo Nordisk are. So, but perhaps on the small country level, it's a little bit more dependent on who are the firms that just managed to make the threshold.
And the other question, which is, sorry, Anton. The other question is about, go.
Okay, so it's so we cleaned a lot more than the Forbes firms. So, and the Bordex has tons of other firms, also Danish firms, but that would be for all the countries. But there, the importance of the careers is much lower. But when we look at all the Danish firms, then not just the Forbes careers, then the pattern reemerges. Like then Maersk is central. So. But if you look only at the Forbes stuff, no, it doesn't. So, but there is, what I also wanted to say with that is there's a much bigger potential than just looking at Forbes careers, because there's a lot more for careers in the Bordex data set.
And it turns out I was wrong, because Maersk is number 3 in Denmark, which in Scandinavia, they weren't that central. So, sorry.
And I had another question, which is about, how does Bordex take into account merger and acquisition when they mention the different firms in which a given individual has done his or her career. So for instance, among your global banking institutes, you have Bank of America, but let's say that the individual that we're interested in spent a couple of years working for Merrill Lynch. Would it be mentioned Merrill Lynch, even though Bank of America acquired Merrill Lynch at some point? It would be written Merrill Lynch.
Okay. It would be written Merrill Lynch, and then through our Wiki cleaning thing, Wiki data would suggest that it was Bank of America. So it would, at least, how we've coded is that if something was merged, then it's the two things that were merged in, you know, together, then it's the resulting firm that we end up with in our data. That is obviously that's a choice, a decision. Is it the right one? No, it's a choice.
Unfortunately, it's already 3 o'clock Central European time, 2 o'clock in the UK. And this means that we have to stop. So I want to thank you all for attending, and don't forget to check in on us again on Wednesday, the 16th of June, Changing Elites. And I'm sure it will be very interesting. So thank you all, and see you in a few weeks from now.